It's October 25th, Monday, Philosophy 201, Ethics, and we're going to talk a little bit about social contract theory and move right into discussing utilitarianism. So let me make sure our sound levels are all right. A little low. Make that direction. Okay, so social contract theory. Another version introduced by Hobbes is the idea that you have a bunch of egoists, a bunch of individuals who are all out for self-interest. And so it might seem that how you should behave is as Glaucon recommends, that you should slink around the shadows, hit people over the head, take their stuff, assault, maim, kill, destroy. But the problem with that is that if you do that, you end up with a place like Guatemala or Burundi, where you have roving bands of brigands assaulting people. And you look at the lifestyle of people who live in Guatemala, and it's pretty damn poor. On the other hand, if you look at the Western world, where you have the rule of law and the police and the army, there might be a downside as far as it might be that you might think in, say, Guatemala, you might have the freedom to do certain things that would be against the law here. Taxes in Guatemala are very low, and it's easy to avoid them. There's very few regulations and restrictions for business. But on the other hand, there's no infrastructure to make sure that once you get off your plane at the airport and you're driving in a convoy, unless you have like an armed convoy and pay a bunch of security people, then even then you're not safe. But there could be a bunch of people with automatic weapons that would jump you and to steal your laptop and your iPhone and all your stuff, and maybe kill you in the process. And so Hobbes' idea is you need the rule of law. Now, what kind of law do you need? What kind of government? You need a government that rules with an iron fist. You need people to fear the government. Because if people don't fear the government, they won't respect the government, and they won't obey the law. It's like if you... Here's an example. I might get in trouble with this one, but what the heck. So, why is it that people who are raised by single mothers, no offense to single mothers out there, I'm sure you do the best you can, and those of you who are raised by single mothers, I'm not casting any aspersions on you, but if you look at it demographically, sociologically, people who are raised by single mothers tend to engage in more delinquent behavior, are more likely to end up in trouble with the criminal justice system. Why is that? Because the father acts as an authority figure. And often, you know, mom is going to be a different authority figure than the father. Fathers tend to be sterner, tend to be more disciplinarian. And so there is the idea of the male role model and so on and so forth. But part of it is just that kind of authority figure in the home telling the kid no and punishing him if he disobeys. Whereas mothers tend to coddle their children more. And I'm not saying this is true of every mother, and certainly I'm sure many of you had mothers who were the pants in the family, and their father is Casper Milktoast, and the mom's a disciplinarian. But if you look at it demographically, the way things average out, that the single-parent households, particularly with the mother as the parent, you end up with people who engage in more delinquent behavior. The same thing with the society. When you have the society with a mamby-pamby government that tells you that you're entitled, that tells you that, and that if you break the law, you get a little slap on the wrist. Well, what are you going to do? You're probably going to say, I'll take my chances. I'll get probation, and you get probation again, and you get double top secret probation, and you never get punished. You just keep on breaking the law. And then other people hear that oh, so-and-so did X, and nothing happened to him. They're like, well, I'm kind of a chump following all these rules when everybody else is breaking them. I think I'll do that too. So Hobbes says you need people to fear the government. You need people, when they think about stealing something, they think about assaulting someone, they're going to think twice if there's a draconian punishment, and if punishment is swift, severe, and certain. Right, that's how you train a pet. If you want to train a pet, you can reward the pet when they do something good. You got to do it right away. And it's got to be a good reward that the animal really wants. And there's got to be the certainty thing for the reward is kind of iffy. That might be problematic. But if you look at punishment works best when it's swift, severe, and certain. And so Hobbes thinks the government needs to work primarily on fear to curb the self-interest of individuals. And paradoxically, this authority serves the enlightened self-interest of everyone. Because if everyone fears the law, then no one is going to be violating the property rights or liberty or or well-being of other people because they fear the law. Because they'll be carted away by the king's soldiers and thrown in the dungeon. And so he thinks... So Hobbes favors a strong central government, but primarily police powers. And Hobbes likes monarchy. Why? Because the king is a strong central figure. People fear the king. You have a democracy, it can never make up its mind. It's, tends to be kind of wishy-washy, not very stable. Now, Hobbes favors monarchy, but, this is an essential to his theory. So you could have a democracy, too, and you, as long as it was strong, and you have this important aspect here, the rule of law. Law and order. And then Hobbes is kind of a libertarian in that he does believe in a kind of a police state. But the police state isn't regulating every aspect of your life. It's only telling you it's only telling you that you can't rob your neighbor, you can't steal from your neighbor, you can't defraud your neighbor. Other than that, you can do what you want. So he's not thinking of a huge welfare state either that's taking from the rich and giving to the poor and kind of doling out benefits to people and making people depend on the government. The government's there just to keep the peace. As far as earning your bread, that's up to you. You gotta work. And you work for your money. If there's somebody in your family that can't work, you have to support them. You have your aged grandmother, it's your responsibility as a grandson to support her. Or you can give to a charity. Or there's the church. Or there's other charitable institutions which exist for those purposes. That's not the government's function. The government's function is to keep the peace. Now, when people talk about social contract theory, they tend to think of Rousseau. Rousseau in the later versions. Which is the idea of the huge welfare state version. Or you might say the socialist version. And this is kind of the minimalist law and order version. You could call this a police state, but police state has sorts of all these negative connotations, right? People think that means that they don't have any freedom. Or Hobbes thinks that the whole reason for the state is to increase your freedom. Because even though you give up some smaller freedoms, you gain in greater freedoms, and that you have the freedom to drive down the road without being assaulted by bandits. And people in America, some parts of America, I guess, if you're living in Compton or some parts of Chicago, it's pretty much like Guatemala. Make sure you don't go down the wrong street. Otherwise, you're going to end up dead or robbed or both. Although if you're dead, I suppose it doesn't matter too much that you're robbed. But so you can Yeah, but there are places in America like that too. But those places tend to be places where law and order, you know, doesn't exist, right? Where people don't really fear the government, where the police don't go into certain areas because they don't want to get shot, and there's no law and order. So, where is he going with this? So Hobbes says that you give up some freedom, but you get more back. And you give up the freedom to steal from your neighbor, but you gain the freedom of not having your neighbor and all your other neighbors stealing from you. And Hobbes says, if you think about it naturally, most people physically are essentially the same. People have, there might be small differences in people's ability to defend themselves, but if you look at a situation where you can take like five mediocre people and one extraordinary person, and the five are usually going to overwhelm the one. And you look at any two individuals, the difference between them isn't all that great. So it's not as if you can have one individual who is able to sort of prosper and lord over other people, that people are pretty much the same, and so each person is vulnerable. And so because you're vulnerable, it's better for you to have society as a whole protecting you with laws and with a central authority and the infrastructure to maintain the peace than it is to live in a state of perpetual warfare with every other individual, which is this idea of the state of nature, which is life without civilization, without the law, without government. And Hobbes also, I think, thinks that if the government's not doing its job, that people will just rebel and create a new government, which is maybe doing the job better. And I think Hobbes would say you have the right to abolish the government. So if the government becomes the thief and the murderer and becomes dictatorial and takes away your freedom, I think Hobbes would say you have the right to rebel because the government's no longer serving your enlightened self-interest. Thoughts, comments, criticisms? What do you think? Yeah.
This is a moral realism view.
Good question. Egoism is a form of moral realism. Although it may be that the difference between egoism and skepticism is a fine line, because you could say, well, morality is a matter of following self-interest, or you could say, since there is no absolute morality, you should just follow self-interest, or people will follow self-interest. So I'd say you could go either way, but yeah, I guess this is a moral realist view. The question is, why should you obey the law when you can get away with not obeying the law? Now, Hobbes would say it's in your enlightened self-interest to follow the law, because everyone following the law leads to a better state than no one following the law. But it seems to me you might say, well, I'm going to urge everyone else to follow the law. I'm going to break the law when I can get away with it. And maybe I'll try to increase the strength of the law so that more people comply with it. But I don't know, is that a legitimate criticism? Like, people say this, what if everybody did X? Like, if I say, well, I'm just, you know, I'm not going to pay my taxes or whatever, I'll cheat on my taxes. And I say, well, what if everyone cheated on their taxes? Then we wouldn't be able to fund the government. And you might say, well, I don't want everyone else to cheat on their taxes, I just want to cheat on my own taxes, because I don't want to pay them. I want everybody else to keep on paying. I like the more people pay them, the better. So I don't want to pay. Is that really an inconsistent position? Or is that rational? In the same way, Hobbes, you could object to Hobbes, you could say, well, this isn't really a tenable view, because it seems like Hobbes is saying you should always obey the law, because the law serves everyone's enlightened self-interest. But if you can get away with breaking the law when it's convenient, why wouldn't you do that? If you could escape punishment, you'd still want the law to be there, and you'd want, in other words, you want the law to punish thieves in general. But if you stole, you wouldn't want the law to punish you. Like, suppose, okay, for example, like I knew this guy way back when, who He had like a computer, and this is like back in the 80s, and it, you know, fell off a truck. He had a friend who was working for some delivery service, and basically sold him this computer he knew he'd stolen. So he got this computer for, you know, $50 or something like that from this guy. And you think, well, now it's in his interest to make sure that his house isn't burgled and that computer isn't stolen. But it's not his interest for it to go to jail for stealing that computer, right? So, is that really inconsistency? You think so? It's hypocrisy, right?
Right.
But maybe hypocrisy is just a word that people use to try to make people buckle down and follow the law. Yeah.
I don't know. Is it really hypocrisy? I mean, hypocrisy seems to be like valuing something and then not doing that thing.
Right.
So you're not valuing the law. You're valuing your self-interest. The law just happens to be in your self-interest.
Yeah, the law is a means to an end, right? The end is self-interest. Remember, Hobbes is an egoist. Hobbes says the reason for the law is it serves everyone's enlightened self-interest. But it doesn't always serve your enlightened self-interest. Sometimes your enlightened self-interest might be served by you breaking the law. So it seems like you come up with examples where it would be good for you to break the law. And just take something like, what's that?
Timothy Geithner.
Yeah, there you go, Timothy Geithner, right. So he's, now actually, was that really in his enlightened self-interest? I'm trying to think of like how much money did he... So he might have saved some money, like cheating on his taxes. But he had like this huge public embarrassment and public embarrassment to the administration. He might not even have gotten that job. If it was a Republican administration, he would have been passed over for somebody who's more honest. But the Democrats don't seem to care about people with the skeletons in the closet. It might even be a resume enhancement. But yeah, so you have the Treasury Secretary, who's in charge of the IRS, cheating his own taxes, right? And he, you know, you got the form that said, hey, you got to pay, you're responsible for your taxes. And so, I mean, he knew, and he's trying to blame it on TurboTax, you know, that somehow. And so you get, so either he's a cheat or he's incompetent, like one or the other, right? Can't even figure out his own personal income taxes using TurboTax. Or he's, you know, trying to avoid. He probably knew that he was supposed to pay. He just figured he wasn't going to get caught. But in that case, I'd say, long range, I think that he wishes that he would have paid those taxes. So maybe that would be a good point for Hobbes here. But it seems like there are other cases where people get away with things where they don't, you know, they're not worried about it. Or where people get away with things and they don't get punished, and then it turned out to be in their interest. Is it always the case? Now, maybe could Hobbes say it's always the case that you know, breaking the law is always a risk that's going to have bad consequences, so you'd almost never want to do it? I don't know. So that's the criticism anyway. Sometimes this is called, Hobbes' view is called legal positivism. Not logical positivism. Legal positivism. Whereas the Riot Act is the legal act. And this, it's so for Hobbes, all there really is to morality is civilization and the law. And for a lot of people, that seems kind of a tenuous basis for morality. Now Hobbes might say, look, it comes back down to egoism, right? So it comes down to self-interest. And it just so happens, this overlaps with Rand, right? Hobbes is probably going to say that people are creatures of habit. If you start breaking the law, pretty soon it's going to become a habit and you'll get caught. And you compare people who are criminals with people who are honest, and the honest people almost always come out ahead. And people that lie, cheat, and steal their way to the top are the exception that proves the rule. And chances are, if you're acting like Bernie Madoff, you're going to get caught eventually, and then you're going to be, you know, spend the rest of your life in prison. And if Madoff just would have, put his skills, and he had a lot of skills, and if he would have put those towards honest work, that he would have still made a lot of money, and he wouldn't have run the risk of jail, and he wouldn't have worried in the middle of the night about whether he was going to be caught, and there's just all sorts of negative consequences for a life of crime. Even if you commit a crime here and there, guilty about it, you worry about getting caught, and then the consequences typically are out of proportion to your benefit. So you commit some little petty crime, but then you end up with a criminal record. That can be really bad for your future employment prospects. If you ever run for public office, it's going to be really bad. It's just embarrassing if it gets out. People find out you have a criminal record. It's something that brings shame on you. Okay, so let's social contract. How about that? What did you think about that last page, the spoof on the social contract? So I hope everyone recognized that was a spoof. Although I suppose the problem with satire is if it's too close to the truth, people don't recognize it as being a joke. Would you ever sign a document like this? Does it seem like a good deal to you? Find this on page
73.
Page 73. And this is just the United States version. The French version would have to be modified. You can retire when you're 62 now, I guess. The French are all rioting in the streets. This whole, by the way, this Rousseau welfare state version, I mean, this is all falling apart now. You look over Europe, people are rioting. The Brits are laying off thousands of government employees. The French are rioting in the streets because the retirement age is being raised from I think, 60 to 62. It's all tumbling down. Meanwhile, we're going in the other direction. Maybe we're going to switch course. Who knows? We'll see what happens in a week. But so here, the social contract theory. Whereas I wish to reside in the North American continent, and whereas the United States government controls the area of the continent where I wish to reside, and whereas tacit or implied contracts are vague and therefore unenforceable, I agree to the following terms. Okay, so there's a lot built in there. This idea that just because you haven't been popped out of your mother's womb, in the territory known as the United States, controlled by, an armed group with certain rules that you have to follow or be fined or thrown into jail or prison, here's all the things that you will have to do. You have to surrender your property to the government. You have to serve in the military. You can't. You can only take those drugs approved by the government. Marijuana right out unless you have a special card. That's changing. So alcohol, tobacco are okay. Marijuana, unless you got like a little permission slip from the state, you're gonna face stiff penalties. Cocaine, meth, right out. A bunch of rules for employment.
Sexual activity,
right. And what else do we have here? The government's not liable to protect you. There have been a number of court cases that say basically the government has no obligation to protect you. You can't sue the police for not keeping robbers out of your home. But if a crazed lunatic hopped up on drugs with a weapon gets into your house and you shoot him, you're probably, unless you live someplace like Texas, you're probably going to be brought up on charges and there's going to be sort of an assumption of guilt. And if the guy was sort of turned sideways or it looked like he was trying to flee or you didn't give him a chance to retreat, and you just shot him because you feared for your life, it's going to be up to you to prove that you feared for your life. And then if you can't, you might end up in prison. Or if you didn't get, if you didn't register that weapon with the government, you're going to be in trouble too. Or you might live someplace like D.C., which up till, I know, the D.C. Heller case, which is just, within the last year, you're not allowed to own a gun. And most metropolitan areas have pretty strong restrictions on owning firearms within the city limits. And then there's all sorts of regulations that you got to have the trigger lock on, you have to keep it in a gun safe, you have to keep the ammunition separate. And if you follow all those regulations, by the time you get your gun out of the gun safe and get the trigger lock out in the middle of the night and you just woke up, the criminal doesn't have the drop on you, he's a pretty dumb criminal. Social Security. Is there anything about Social Security in here? I can't remember. The government will attempt to protect my life and claim that the property is allowed me to keep. I agree not to hold the government liable if it fails to protect me. The government will offer various services to me. The nature and extent of these services will be determined by the government and are subject to change at any time. Well, maybe there's an implicit thing about Social Security there. So anyway, this is sort of a joke in that it tells it like it is. It's like, this is the situation you're in, and so the idea that there's some sort of implicit social contract that you agree to do all these things, I think the author would say is absurd. That nobody would willingly sign such a contract. But somehow people create the fiction that simply by continuing to live in the United States that you agree to buy all these draconian rules. Now some people will say, well look, if you don't like it in America, get out, go someplace else. Well, what do you think about that? Is that a fair criticism?
It's a democracy. You have the right to say, I don't like this case.
It's a republic.
Right.
Okay, democratic. I call it, let's say. Right. So you have the right to dissent. They're written in the Constitution, you might say. But you could say, look, if your dissenting isn't working, if people don't want to do what you want to do, just go someplace else. Well, where are you going to go? It's worse almost every other place. Although, depending on what you want, maybe Singapore might be a good deal. If you're looking for economic freedom, there's probably about five other countries you can go to. Singapore, Australia, Hong Kong, one of these areas. Well, it's not quite as bad here. So if you want to keep more of your money, you go there. But you go to Singapore, and you have a lot more sort of moralistic laws that you have to deal with. If you want more social freedom, maybe you go to the Netherlands or Sweden. And you pay like 80% of your money to the government, but you can go into a... in the Netherlands, you can go into a coffee bar and smoke a joint, and you can have your same-sex marriage, and you get a more social freedoms. But the thing is that in every major country, there's a whole bunch of rules that you have to follow or else. And it's just, it seems like this idea that if you don't like the rules, you have to move, and if you agree to live in a certain place, you have to accept where the rules are, seems... It seems irrational to me, because what did the founding fathers say when Great Britain said, here are the rules and here's what you have to do? I said, well, hell no. We want to create our own rules, and they had a revolution. So it seems like that's always an option open to people too, if the rules become too burdensome. Thomas Jefferson suggested that the tree of liberty needs to be replenished from time to time with the blood of patriots. Yeah.
Don't you think that most of us tend to give a little bit with a lot of those rules? Like, I saw some guys snagging fish down below my house one day. These guys are just jerking salmon out like they were going out of style. I hollered down there, hey, how you guys doing? Not very good. I haven't got anything yet. And I was thinking in my head, well, if this guy's starving or something and he needs a fish, that's okay with me. But after 10 of them, he's not starving. He's you know, outsell them to whoever legally.
Right.
So my point was, it seems like there should be, or how I feel is, there's always a little bit I'm willing to flex with the law or a little bit, but then there's also the point where this is rational or crazy or.
Yeah. So like, and for most people, they'd say, hey, look, you know, if the government was going to take like 10%, and maybe 5% went to the local community for schools and things, and then maybe another 3%. Went to the state, and then maybe 2% went to the federal government for homeland defense, and maybe the FBI to track interstate, you know, kidnappings and crimes like that. That would be okay. That would be a government of the size and scope I could live with, and that wouldn't be too much of a burden on me. But when the government's going to take 50, 60%, 70% of my money, when you think of add up the state, local, and federal taxes, capital gains taxes, the various fees you have to pay for things, gasoline tax, phone tax, internet tax, tax, right? You got all these taxes, and a lot of them are these little taxes that are just built into the price of gasoline. Like, can anybody here tell me like what the what the taxes are on gasoline, like how much of a price of gas, the cost of gas of a gallon of gasoline is a tax?
35 cents. I think it's
35. Oh, somebody actually
knows. It used to be a total of between 30 and 40 cents from the state government or state feds per gallon.
And that's more than the greedy oil company makes off that gallon of gas. So essentially, the government, for doing nothing, gets more profit than the oil company gets on that gallon of gas as a function of the retail process. Because typically, you're looking at like between 8 and 10% for the oil company. It's just they make it up on volume, right? Because America runs on oil. Anyway, but all those taxes add up. So you think about, well, if half of my income goes to the government, then I'm half a slave, right? It's like being an indentured servant half the year. And there's this tax freedom day every year, and it moves around a little bit, but it usually comes around May, where if you think about, well, I'm working, your average middle-class person is going to be working till May to pay the taxes. You think about it that way, you're thinking, this is a crazy system. And you think about the fact that the founding fathers rebelled against a few isolated taxes on tea and sugar and legal documents, and having to put up soldiers for the night when they're coming through town, that was what the revolution was about. And it makes you scratch your head and wonder what Thomas Jefferson or Tom Paine or Ben Franklin would think if they looked at today's society and the level of taxation and regulation and government intrusion into people's lives. So I think that's something to be said on behalf of, I think, the Hobbes version and also on behalf of Rand. Now, we're going to look at utilitarianism in a minute, which may support a different view or maybe not. We'll have to look at that. But if you're looking at what serves the interests of individuals, I think you make a pretty good case that as government expands, liberty contracts. So some of the I think the big criticism of Hobbes is that Hobbes thinks that if you have a strong central government, that it could be limited. The problem with government is it tends to grow in power. And if you have a monarchy, you have entrenched interests who are also, don't forget that the monarch himself follows self-interest. So he's going to take as much as power as he can over people's lives. He doesn't care. The point at which he cares is when people get so upset about their lives that they're going to rebel. And if he's got enough soldiers, he's not going to worry about the rebellion either. So that seems like it's a problem. And I think Thomas Jefferson would make a good argument against Hobbes that it's better when the government fears the people than when the people fear the government. Jefferson said, when the people fear the government, there's tyranny. But when the government fears the people, there's liberty. And so if the government worries about, like if we pass this law, like, okay, here's a good example. So Lane County, the bureaucrats in Lane County that are going for this big land grab. They want to make sure that if you own property by the river, that you can't do a damn thing to it within 200 feet of the river. So these people that paid large, you know, sums for riverfront property, and they got like a little easement, and they got, you know, a path going down the river, and maybe they got like a little rowboat down there. The kids like to go swimming. And you know what, I don't know if you know what it's like by the river, but blackberries grow like crazy. So the idea is that you can't do anything within 200 feet of the river that's sort of going to be like, almost like public property, except for nobody's going to be using it. And you're going to have to let the blackberries grow. And there's all sorts of like lousy excuses about water quality, but they want to increase this from 50 feet to 200 feet. And they're going to be a meeting Tuesday night, and probably you'll just get like a handful of landowners up there to object, and then the bureaucrats will pass a law, and people, there'll be lots of people there that haven't even heard that law was going to pass because the meeting hasn't been well publicized, and all of a sudden you get your private property and you can't use it anymore, and if you try to sell it, it's going to be worth a lot less, and that's, you know, and that's just sort of the way things happen. And when you have a large centralized government, it just tends to get bigger and bigger, and it tries to do more and more for the supposed common good, and taking away people's property and people's right to enjoy the use of their property, and for, you know, so the supposed common good. Harris Hall, if anybody's interested in property rights, at 6:30. All right, on Tuesday. Let's see. Let's talk about utilitarianism.
This thing come on?
Yeah. Oh, there it is.
So is that Tuesday tomorrow?
Tomorrow. Tomorrow, Tuesday, 6:30, 8:30, Harris Hall, 125 East 8th Street. If you have a contrary view, if you think that 200 feet is, you know... If you know anyone with riverfront property, you might tell them to show up, or if you just care about property rights, I'm going to try to make it down there. But this is like, you can talk in theory about like, oh, big government, small government, but this is like a local issue that really affects people. I was actually looking at a house like 2 years ago that was on the river in Cottage Grove, and I would have been subject to this. And if you look down by the river, you see all those blackberries, and they're just a nightmare. Anyhow.
Yeah. 200 feet might eliminate some of those properties totally.
Yeah.
So
my dad has a house, and it's 50 feet from the water.
Uh-huh.
And like, we live on a creek, and that's plenty enough. And 200 feet would literally be across the road. So
yeah.
Our house would be non-existent.
Yeah, so it's, and this is like the Lane County Commissioners, I think, or something. So it's Harris Hall, 125 East 8th Street, from 6, I think the meeting from 6:30 to 8:30. Make sure this is being picked up. This is one of the things where no people aren't voting on it. It's just, they might even do it by a voice vote or a show of hands or something. County commissioners, you know, just vote on these things. They're elected. It's one thing you want to look at, like if you show up at the meeting, you see that the people who are in favor of that, maybe you might want to vote against them. Although, I mean, you might be in favor of it, you might think there are reasons that people give for them. I don't think they're any good, but, I want to make sure that I'm not electioneering here. I'm not telling you to go down there and vote a certain way, but it's something that people should be aware of when they're thinking about, you know, if you believe in property rights and if you believe in freedom, that's... it's something you might want to look into. Let's put it that way. Okay. I'll post this like in the social form, I think, too. All right. The thing is that, like, there's so many different... You have the city, the county, the state, and the federal government. And you have all these different regulatory agencies. And, you know, every day these people go to work thinking, what new rules can we make up that everybody else has to follow? So any individual, even if you like scour the news every day, you could, it could be a full-time job just showing up to these damn meetings and shaking your fist in the air and saying hell no, and it's you and a few other clowns waving signs, and the bureaucrats typically just do what they're going to do, like this Randy Pape belt line. I don't know if anybody followed that. So you have this guy who's like a fat cat contributor to TED and Governor Kulongoski, and local businessman, and he dies, and that's sad. Sounded like he was a great guy, and his family said, "Hey, how about hey Ted, how about naming this the something after him? How about like the highway?" So this looked like it was started by his family, and they said, "Hey, let's name a highway after this guy that just died, this businessman." It's like, well, how much are the signs going to cost? $500,000. Well, gee, I don't know. Lane Community College could use that $500,000 to defray tuition costs, new families, work on more parking. There's homeless people. You think of all the things you could use and what you could do with that $500,000, but they're going to use it to change some street signs to celebrate the life of some guy that just died who happens to be rich and happens to be a contributor to the governor. And I was thinking, well, why not just like rename Mahonia Hall, the governor's mansion, call it Randy Pape Hall, right? That would be easy, and you just have to change one sign. But now you have all the local businesses and all their websites and all their promotional literature. It all has to be changed. And now it's the same Beltline, Randy Pape Beltline. And it's just this one of those little things. And you had like angry people, like scores and scores of people, and the protesters outnumbered the supporters like by 50-1. There's only maybe one or two people there speaking in support of it. And there's people, angry people there, people in the news waving signs, people showed up to the meeting, and the bureaucrats just passed it anyway. And then they made some false promises that the signage wasn't going to cost that much, that the signs needed to be replaced anyway, none of which was true. And it ended up actually costing twice as much as they had estimated. So I think the original estimate was $250,000, and ended up being $500,000.
Okay, let's talk about utilitarianism.
Oh, that's right.
And I'll post these notes up on the Moodle along with the podcast. Utilitarianism is based on the concept of utility.
Over here a little bit.
What is utility? Utility is net pleasure or happiness. So this is kind of a weird terminology, because most people think about utility, they think about usefulness. And Mill says, I'm not talking about utility as usefulness. I'm talking about utility of use in a technical way. It means you take all the pleasure on one hand, you take all the pain and subtract on the other hand, and then what's left is net pleasure. How much pleasure you get overall. So it's net pleasure or happiness, which Mill uses synonymously. Happiness is just a way of describing a certain amount of pleasure. And the pleasures aren't necessarily physical pleasure. It can be emotional pleasure or spiritual pleasure, if there is such a thing. It's talking about generally good feelings, positive mental states. So utilitarians tend to use happiness and utility interchangeably. So what is the right act under utilitarianism? the right act is that which maximizes happiness. So you think of all the things I could do right now, what will create the most long-term happiness? And that will be the right act. You can count yourself, but unlike egoism, you can only count yourself as much as anybody else. Now, you might be able to favor yourself for certain reasons, like, well, I know what I want more than other people know what they the more than I know what other people want. So I know, like, think about Christmas time, right? If Christmas time's coming up pretty soon, if you participate in the gift giving, like, you know what you want for Christmas, but you might not know what your loved one wants for Christmas or what your best friend wants for Christmas. You have to ask them. And, of course, if you ask them, what do you want for Christmas, that kind of, like, spoils the whole idea of the surprise, right? So you kind of, like, sort of try to guess, and sometimes it's like you're like, out in that field. You get something... you probably all had all the experience when you're a kid, and, like, you want, like, a certain thing, like... Anybody have like an experience where you ask your parents for one thing and they got something that was sort of like it but like totally off?
A puppy, yeah. Every year.
What's that?
Every year, right?
Yeah, every year, yeah. Socks and underwear. Gee, just what I wanted, Mom. A sweater. Oh,
sweater that's too small.
I love the sweater, Grandma. Right. Or like you want, I don't know, like you want the latest Mega Man and... your mom gets you like a Power Ranger, or you want like a Lord of the Rings DVD, and you get like Harry Potter, or what, you know, whatever it is. Yeah. You think about. I remember as a kid, I got this son of it was Origins of Marvel Comics. It's like all the classic Marvel comics, Fantastic Four and Iron Man and the Hulk, and it's like how they, you know, how the first issue, how they started. I'm like, oh, this is really cool, and. There was the price is actually on there, and it's like it was $5.95 for this big, you know, soft-bound book. And my mom thinking, oh, you know, you don't want people to know how much you paid. She took like a black felt pen and put like a line through the price there. Ah, you've ruined it, right? This is a comic, but it's like a collector's item, right? You don't touch it with a pen. You don't even like wrinkle the pages, right? You wrap it in cellophane. And so she like totally ruined it. But she was trying to do something that she thought would have been nice, that would have been created the most happiness. Now, if I bought it, I would never would have done that to my own Origins of Marvel comic collector's book, right? So, so you know how to please yourself more than other people know how to please you typically. So maybe that would allow you to favor yourself some. But you have to primarily think about like other people, the whole world. It might be family and friends. It's easier to make them happy than a complete stranger, too, right? Because you know about their interests. So maybe you can favor them a little bit. But you have to think about strangers, too. Oh, there's two parts of utilitarianism. One is this theory of value. The theory of value of utilitarianism is hedonism. Hedonism says that only pleasure is intrinsically valuable. What does intrinsically valuable mean? It means valuable a part of what else it can get you. Valuable just for its own sake. So if something's intrinsically valuable, it might be useful in getting something else of value, but even if it isn't, you still want it. So this is all a Henry Youngman joke. What good is happiness? It can't buy you money. And why does that sort of make you snicker? It's not like a big belly laugh thing, but... I like take my wife, please. Right, so that's another ending thing. So anyway, this idea that happiness is something which is valuable for its own sake. You never like if your friend, you know, is like has a bunch of you know problems and they say, I just want to be happy, and you'll say, well, why would you want that? Why do you want to be happy? You say, well, there isn't like an extra reason. I just do, because happiness is valuable for its own sake. That's part of the meaning of life, to be happy. And so happiness is, most people accept as an intrinsic value. But then the question is it the only intrinsic value? And hedonism shouldn't be confused with this idea of, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, and focus on physical pleasure. And people tend to think about hedonists as people that that want to, you know, get drunk and go out and have sex with strangers and, you know, drop X and dance to trance music all night or something. So hedonism here, in the philosophical sense as opposed to the popular sense, means that the only thing of value is pleasure, and things are only valuable in as much as they produce pleasure. So theory of value. Theory of action, consequentialism. So consequentialism is a theory that says that only the results of an act are relevant to its moral evaluation. So when you're trying to think about whether an act is right or wrong, you shouldn't look at what type of act it is. You shouldn't look at any quality in the act itself. You only want to look at the results. What will this act lead to? What is the goal of this act? How likely is that goal to be accomplished? So you think about the phrase, the ends justifies the means, and the consequentialists would agree with this. They would say that the ends, the end result, the goal, justifies the means used to accomplish that goal. So if you can torture a terrorist to find out where the nuclear bomb is so it doesn't go off, then the goal of saving 10 million people from being burned alive and all the other bad consequences from a nuclear bomb going off in a major city justifies the infliction of pain on the terrorist. That would be a consequentialist justification. Also, in consequentialism, the motive is also irrelevant. The motive of the agent, as well as the qualities in the act itself, are irrelevant. So suppose you need to find out where the bomb is, and you need someone who's really good at torturing. So what do? You call in, like, Joe, torture expert, maybe from another country where torture is a matter of course, right? You get some guy who's really good at torturing people. And he doesn't really care about the nuclear bomb. He actually thinks it would be kind of cool to see a nuclear bomb go off, see what it would do to people, because he's a sadist. But the thing about sadists is they're really good at torturing people. They can inflict the maximum amount of pain, and you think, well, if you can inflict the right kind of pain on this guy, he's going to talk. And so, but it doesn't matter that this guy is only torturing the terrorists to find out the information, or only because he wants to inflict pain on this person for his own personal pleasure, if this will indeed lead to the nuclear bomb not going off. The goal would justify that. And whether this guy is doing it for the fun of it or whether he's doing it because he wants to save innocent people, it doesn't really matter. What matters is whether or not that bomb goes off and whether those 10 million people live or die. So these two parts of these two theories, hedonism and utilitarianism, these two theories, hedonism and consequentialism together, make up utilitarianism. So you could be a hedonist and not be a utilitarian. You could be a hedonist and be an egoist, right? You could think, morality is a matter of self-interest. What's in my interest? As much pleasure and happiness as possible. Knowledge, doesn't really do anything for me. Freedom, well, if freedom brings pleasure, it's good. But if freedom brings responsibility and pain, then that's bad. So you don't care about anything but pleasure. Whose pleasure do you care about? Your own pleasure. You could be a consequentialist and not be a hedonist. Well, what would that be like? You think of example. What would be an example of a person? What would a consequentialist be like who isn't a hedonist? Yeah.
Someone who values freedom. So.
Yeah. So like a libertarian or someone who just thinks that freedom is really important. Like most of the founding fathers. Valued freedom. I don't know if they were consequentialists, but you can think of a person who values freedom or knowledge as well as happiness, maybe instead of happiness, but also thinks that it's the end result of your actions that matters, not the means you get used to achieve them. Yeah.
Oh, it would be like inquisitor too. It's like, what was it, like better for a dozen men to, for a dozen innocents to die than for one to go unpunished? So, I mean, that would be consequentialist right there, too. I mean, you're looking at the degrees, like,
right.
In which degree was more bigger evil. But I mean, like, there was, like, I think St. Martin's report was that it's, like, better for, like, a dozen innocents to die than for one wish or unpunished or something like that. So, I mean, that would definitely be consequentialism.
Yeah. Yeah, sure, that would be, so the idea is that you're weighing the consequences, and you're thinking, well, if I could kill, it's worse that one rich lives than 10 innocent people die, and so you kill them all, and let God sort them out.
Yeah, right. Exactly. If that would be
sure.
a good phrase for the consequences, uh-huh. It would be kill them all, let God sort them out.
And you can also think about the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The idea is that, well, we want to minimize the loss of life, and one of the justifications given, which turns out not to be a very good justification, but one of the justifications given is that a land war would be bloody, and not just Americans, but a lot of Japanese would be killed because they're going to fight the last man. The experience on Okinawa showed that casualties were extremely high on both sides, and so the idea is to avoid that. You make Japan surrender unconditionally. How? By killing, you know, a couple hundred thousand civilians, and then drop another bomb and kill another couple hundred, so that Japan throws up its hands and says, okay, there's no way we can fight against that. And so that coerced an unconditional surrender. But, you know, we also, or the United States also killed, 200,000 people. And that's, you know, those are, you know, just civilians, right? So that would be a kind of consequentialist justification. And it turns out that Japan is already trying to surrender, and had pretty much said they were going to accept the terms that we eventually ended the war with. So there might have been some other things going on there too. But if that really was a justification, then that would be a consequentialist justification for dropping the bomb. And the idea is that you're going to kill 200,000 civilians to avoid, say, 500,000 deaths of soldiers and civilians together or something on both sides. Okay, Nozick's experience machine. Oh, that's not seeable at all. Somebody should turn off the light in the back, please, in the front here. It's horrible and washed out. Oh, much better. So, philosopher Robert Nozick has this thought experiment, the experience machine. And, you know, within your lifetimes, we might have such a machine. So in the experience machine, you're hooked up to a machine, and you can be given any pleasurable experience that you desire. You can, you know, think about all the different things you'd like to experience. If you want to be like in a Star Trek world, say you're a Star Trek geek, and you get to be like, you know, on a spaceship exploring around and fighting aliens and doing all that cool stuff. And you could decide, like, you know, what sorts of things you want built into the experience. And maybe even you could work it out so that you could come out every once in a while and make some adjustments. But when you go back in, what they do is they either wipe out your memories of your current life, or there's some sort of, built-in transition. So maybe they create a false memory where, sort of like on Stargate, right? They take the computer nerd and they come to him and say, we want you to be part of the secret project, and they beam him up to the starship and off he goes. So you could have some sort of transition built in where the key part of the simulation is you don't know it's simulation. And that's part of what makes it pleasurable. So then the question is, would you want to hook up to a machine which would give you any experience that you would want, and but would have no other value? So in other words, this experiment caused you to think, if I could have a life of optimal happiness, would I choose that life over my life right now? And so you can have happiness in this, but no other value. So what do you think? And suppose you'd live as long in the machine as you would in real life, and that nobody would miss you. So maybe we create like a robot or a clone to like take your place or something. So you'd have to worry about, you know, feeding those feral cats or taking care of your wife or whatever. Or maybe, you know, maybe you it, there we they fake a car accident, but you know, there's $1 million insurance payment, and your wife says that's not such a bad deal. So what do you think? How many people here would want to be hooked up to the machine?
Depends.
Okay, what would it depend on?
It depends. If I was in my 80s or something, and I just had Alzheimer's and constant pain, that reality would be better than the current one. But presently, that would be lost, too much control, I wouldn't do it. But if I was wheelchair bound and miserable and in pain, I'd do it in a minute.
So you think control is important to you?
Yeah. Right now, it's at the point that I lose control of my body or faculties, then.
But you think that would be something that would be missing there, is like control or freedom, self-determination or something? Okay. Yeah, Blake.
Yeah, an important question to ask is, do you value truth? Do we value truth? I mean, we go to college, we learn things that may disturb us or outside of what we do, because on the premise of wanting to discover the truth, or at least know the truth, different from what we understand it is now. And so, you know, we could say that we would hook ourselves up to this machine, and, you know, it would give us these pleasurable feelings, but we would know that it wasn't the truth as we, you know, want to experience it. So I think that is kind of a big part of that.
Truth, the knowledge of the truth, control, freedom. What else? Yeah. Too much happiness. Yeah, Evan?
As like a counter argument to his thought experiment, the knowledge that you've contributed to society can give you so much more pleasure. It's more pleasurable to knowing that a piece of you essentially is going to live on in society forever, that you contribute eternally to the salvation and happiness of others.
Mm. So that's more of a sort of an other regarding goal. Can you say that last part again? Make sure it's
what?
The last part of what you said.
Oh, about like your contributing gives you more pleasure because you know that there will be a piece of you that is eternal, essentially, in society.
Well, I mean, you would have that same belief in the machine, it would just be false. So you could get the experience even of, like, giving, you know, to charity, or maybe your, I mean, maybe your fantasy would be of, like, helping the poor and starving people in the third world. And maybe you, like, live a life like Mother Teresa. You could have your Mother Teresa simulation. You just wouldn't actually be helping anybody. Yeah.
Part of what makes happiness so great is you experience other feelings, like pain and frustration and other things that make you are happy that much better. Would you have those things, or would it just be?
So, needed for contrast. And then I think these two things are related. This idea of boredom, the state of boredom. And I can say here that you can have a variety of pleasures, and that might be enough. Like, think about, okay, think about food for a minute. Like, food is pleasurable to eat, and but you get bored eating the same thing every day. But do you ever get bored eating? I mean, it seems that what makes eating pleasurable, you know, you can tell by looking at me, I don't ever get bored eating. But what makes eating pleasurable is you eat a variety of things. Now, in order to appreciate the taste of, oh, I made this like great like bean dip. It was like those Taco Bell refried beans without any fat in them, and I put in a little bit of cheese, and I put in some diced onions and tomatoes, and I stirred it around and put in a clove of garlic and ate it on some corn chips, and it was like the Mission tortilla chips. And it was just delicious. Now, it was to enhance that culinary experience. Should I have found like a rotten piece of fruit and like, you know, bite into it? Maybe like an apple with some worms on it. It just like tasted like crap. Or maybe like should I keep a gallon of spoiled milk in my fridge? And I wouldn't have to swallow it, but I just kind of swig it around and like or maybe I should like drink some regular, like suck on a lemon for like an hour, and then drink some milk, and then brush my teeth, and then drink some orange juice, and then I could like eat my. I'd say, well, that was awful. Will my food be any more pleasurable? I would say no. Like, should I commit a crime to go to prison for 10 years so I'll appreciate my freedom more? So, yeah.
But you can eat, like, really healthy all week and then, like, on Friday,
you eat, like, it's like, so the question is, do you need to go from negative 10 to positive 10, or do you need to go from, like, 1 to 10? So this negative 10 would be pain, right? And this positive 10 would be the height of pleasure. Well, maybe what you need is just like the mildest of pleasure, like the pleasure of eating a stick of celery, right? Maybe that, you know, or like a plain piece of bread and a glass of water. That's kind of like your lowest level. But and maybe that's what you, that's all you need. That you, but the idea that you need pain, it's kind of like thinking that, like, I should like sit here with a 2x4 and hit myself over the head with it repeatedly because when I stop it feels so good. Right? It seems like pain is bad, pleasure is good. If you have like a scale of pleasure, that would give me enough contrast. You would need pain to create the proper contrast to appreciate the pleasure. Say, way in the back.
Now, when I first read that, I thought, well, there's no way I'd want to be hooked up to the machine because you don't know what you're going to miss in real life. But then when I was done with it, I thought, well, piss on that. I'll hook you up. If I could just have nothing but pleasure all day in and out, why not?
You'd be missing out on some bad things. But you, I mean, you'd be missing out on some good things, but you know they're going to miss out on some bad things, right? Old age, cancer, large prostate, you know, you think about all the things.
Arguments.
Yeah, arguments, you know. Watching your partner get really, really old and not have enough money to trade in for a younger one. Like, think about all the, like, you know, watching the country go to hell, watching the younger generation grow up and not have any respect for the elders. You know, going out in your front yard, yelling at the kids to get off your lawn. Think of all the things that you know, in the future, that, and, you know, dealing with paying bills and just the day-to-day stuff. Now, if you were really kind of a masochist, like if you're going to be in the Star Trek world, you could have it work it out so that, okay, well, you're going to be like, you want to be Captain Picard. You could work it out where maybe you're doing boring paperwork for an hour for contrast. If that floats your boat, you could build that into your scenario, right? If it were me, it would be all spaceships and aliens and ray guns and the exciting part, and maybe some R&R as a contrast. But the boring paperwork, I just get rid of that entirely. Let's send it over to Hannah first. I think Evan and Blake.
Back to my criticism of... certainly you could trick yourself into thinking that you contributed, but the question is would you? You know, it seems like we derive pleasure from knowing the truth, and so even though we could choose that, when we're consciously making the decision, knowing that it's a lie, we wouldn't do that because we find that horrible, you know, lying to yourself, essentially.
Yeah, people don't like the idea of lying to themselves. They want to know the truth. Even if the truth will cause them pain, right? Sometimes it's to like stave off future pain. But it may be like, imagine you're with a long-term partner. You've been together for 10 years, and you find some evidence that maybe 10 years ago that your partner was getting it on with your best friend. Your best friend has since like moved to China, and he's not anywhere in the picture. And if there was an affair, it's over with. But you gotta know. And some people would say, well, even though finding out the truth might cause me pain, I'd rather know the truth than live a lie or something. But I think some other people would say, well, no, look, I don't even want to know. I'm gonna suppress this. I'm not gonna forget I ever saw this, and I'm never gonna ask about it because I don't want to know. And why? Because I want to be happy, and I don't care whether this happened or not. I don't want to face it. And so I prefer to believe that my partner's been faithful to me all this time. Yeah?
I think a big portion of the happiness that you feel from something pleasurable comes from the fact that you've done something you deserve it. Like, if you're a kid and you get toys and video games and Christmas presents and all that stuff, it's okay, but then, the kid gets tired of it pretty fast, whereas pretty fast. When you're an adult, and you work for those things, and you pay money for them, you've suffered, you've struggled, you contributed yourself into, these possessions, you feel like you've earned them, and then you enjoy them that much more because you remember, what you put forward, to get those things. And I think that many people would subconsciously prefer to be in this machine, but not know that they made that decision, if that makes any kind of sense. Like, they would not choose to voluntarily submit themselves to it, but if it could just happen, they would prefer to be in it. I think that, that feeling is important.
Yeah.
When you said Star Trek, this is the old Star Trek, the Captain Pike episode, he's in a wheelchair.
Right, yeah.
Took him back to that planet, it's the same thing.
Yeah, that's a good example. I actually had a friend who went to a Star Trek convention and got to meet the guy who played Captain Pike there, and just like recently. But yeah, so he gets to, he finally chooses to be with the aliens who give him the illusion of being able-bodied again. Because he's, he's in like this sort of futuristic wheelchair and half his face is burned off. And so he's like an invalid. And so he says, whereas he's like a young, handsome, able-bodied person in the fantasy the aliens give him. But he's controlled. He's like a caged animal in a kind of a experiment because these aliens like to observe human reactions. And they're kind of studying him in kind of a zoo-like thing. And at the end of the episode, he goes back to being in the zoo because the zoo was better than living as a crippled, disfigured person. But the thing is, if you think about what your life is now and what your best life in your imagination could be, it seems like that's sort of the same sort of step, in that it's not so that the difference between being sort of disfigured and not able to get around and having a normal life would be as much of a leap from your normal life to like the life you can imagine, right? And whatever excitement. Think about all the things you enjoy doing and all the things you hate doing. And then imagine that you would never have to do any of those things you hate doing ever again. And that all the pleasant experiences that you gravitate towards, the things you do on the weekend when you don't have to work in your job, frivolous entertainments, the good relationships. What about relationships? All those things would be there. Like, if you wanted, maybe you're having problems with your partner, you want like a new partner. You could have whoever right here. Angelina Jolie. I guess she might be not what's hot now. You think about there's a supermodel, right? Or maybe it's like a guy that doesn't drink too much or something for the ladies, whatever it is. Or some guy with a bunch of tattoos and muscles. The thing about earning it, I think about like all the, working out. Like, if I could take a pill that would make me, svelte and muscular and, and make my body the way I would, like those, like on the Bowflex commercials, as opposed to like working and sweating in the gym for like, a couple hours a day, I'd take the pill. I wouldn't feel guilty. I wouldn't feel like I didn't earn it. I'd say, hey, shortcuts are great. Same thing with like money. If you get rich overnight, that's great. Do I feel guilty about not earning it? I don't know. Maybe that's something you'd have to get over or something. How about you? You would never have any relationships. It would be, you'd have the illusion of relationship, but it wouldn't be real. You'd just be interacting with the computer. So it would seem that you were in a relationship, but it would just be like you interacting with a machine. And you wouldn't know it, though. Did you have a comment or question?
Well, I was just wondering about the relationship. Like, could you have the same relationship you had in life? Like, would you have a partner before the machine?
They'd just be programmed in there, like really, really super realistically, so that you wouldn't know the difference. A lot of people say if you didn't know the difference, then there isn't a difference.
Except that you would know that
was written.
Well, you know, you wouldn't know this.
Oh,
obviously.
So this is, yeah, you have no idea. You mentioned,
right. Yeah, they're like, you know, whatever it'd be like, you know, you all of a sudden you'd remember being like beamed aboard the spaceship, and your partner was there and said, "Hey, the aliens want both of us," or whatever, and you go off on your adventure. Yeah.
So it's kind of like a total recall, right?
Yeah.
So you don't need, I mean, all your previous memory is also implanted, so you just like whatever.
Well, they could, like I said, they could be kind of integrated in some clever way.
Yeah.
It's just that none of it would be real. Now what? So now you thought about some more. How many people would want to be hooked up? Anybody? Okay, just one. Two, okay, how many people wouldn't want to be hooked up? Okay. So next time, let's talk a little bit about why you wouldn't want to be hooked up, and then we'll move on and talk about germ phantom and more about utilitarianism. Nozick says that if you wouldn't want to be hooked up, that means that you're not a hedonist. You have some other values besides pleasure.
Thank you.